In this episode, Garrick Jones talks about going from opera to author, and Justine reviews our first triple hitter recommendation.
Welcome to Gay Mystery Authors with Brad Shreve, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. Plus, Justine Adamek is here with her weekly recommendation.
Before we get to Justine's reviews, I wanted to remind everybody, John Michelson was our guest last week, and his interview was on Thanksgiving Day. So during the busy holiday weekend, you may have missed it. You sure go back and check it out. He talks about his latest Kendall Parker mystery, The Deadwood Murders. It's a great interview. The Deadwood Murders is currently on pre-order, and it releases tomorrow on December 6th. So be sure to check that out. And we're going to go right to Justine. You have some things to talk about Requeer Tales.
Well, Requeer Tales has got their Dead on Your Feet, which is the third in the Stan Krajicek series by Grant Michaels. It is available on pre-order, and it will release on Tuesday, December 10th.
Okay, and you also are going to give us a review on Greg Herron?
Greg Herron's newest book. Greg Herron is one of the more well-known and one of the best authors in the gay mystery genre. He's won 2 Lambda Awards, and he's been nominated for 10 other awards.
We need to get him on the show.
That would be terrific. He's got some long-running mystery series, the Chance McLeod series, and also the Scotty Bradley mysteries. When it comes to readers, some people prefer the Chance McLeod, and some people prefer the Scotty Bradley. You know, I think you should try them both, Brad, and see which one you like, and you'll probably like them both enough to read them through. So the Scotty Bradley mystery, the newest book is out, Royal Street Rebellion. It came out in September. The first Scotty Bradley mystery came out in 2003, and when I first discovered Greg Herron, only the third book on was available in ebooks. And he released the first book, again, as an ebook last year, but the second book in the series, Jackson Street Jazz, isn't out in the ebook yet. This one, I couldn't figure out what kind of recommendation to give us. It qualifies for a glowing recommendation and a thrilling recommendation and an intriguing recommendation. I was hoping for flaming, but there was no flaming in this book. It is a straight mystery.
But he's the first one to get 3 ratings.
Yeah, this is really a phenomenal book, and I would look for it in the Lambda Awards this year. We'll see if it gets nominated, but I suspect it will.
Anything more you can tell us about the story?
I can. So the Scotty Bradley is an ex-go-go dancer. Because the first book came out in 2003, he's now over 40 and regretting the aging a little bit, but coming to terms with it. He's part of a thruple. He is living with his ex-FBI turned professional wrestler boyfriend, Frank, and his undercover black ops guy named Colin. And they also have living with them Frank's nephew, Taylor. So that's the basic setup of characters. There are some wonderful minor characters, including Scotty's parents, who are old hippies, and who whenever you go to their house, they're smoking good marijuana out of a dragon bong, and they always offer everybody some, and they send some home with Scotty, and they approach life in their wise, hippie-valued ways. They make wonderful minor characters. The premise of the story is the Grand Dames series is launching a new franchise, Grand Dames of New Orleans, and it's a Thinly Skies Real Housewives series. And he and Taylor are going to the premiere, and by morning there are not one, not two, but 3 murders. Some of which may be related, all of which may be related. They all have things in common, but maybe not. So he starts it off with a bang with those 3 murders.
I like a good body count.
I look and over, yeah, the body count rises over the time. And it gets the intriguing mystery because there's no shortage of suspects, no shortage of motives. The killer is well hidden. It's just a wonderful book. It's a well-crafted mystery. And I think you'll really enjoy it.
Well, it sounds good because you lost me there for a second when you said go-go dancer, but then
ex-go-go dancer.
Well,
and, you know. And it's in New Orleans. I got to tell you, you know, I can't believe you're holding it against them.
Oh, no, I'm not holding it against them at all. It just that's where my mind went. But you brought me right back, and it sounds like a great story.
And remember, even though he's an ex-go-go dancer, there's no flaming recommendation on this book.
Okay, that's fine. He got a triple, so that's nothing to complain about there.
Yes, it's a well-crafted mystery. I think you'll enjoy it. You don't need to read the rest of the series to know what's going on. And he doesn't do a lot of backstory. He'll say, well, I was kidnapped before. Well, that's a long story. Well, I was this before. Well, that's another long story. And then he just keeps going.
And, you know, I love that. It drives me crazy when there's a series and you can't just pick up one in the middle. So
right.
It makes me happy to hear.
And it also drives me crazy when all of a sudden they're interrupting the story to give you a summary of the previous plot.
True.
So I think he handles that all very well.
Well, it sounds like a winner.
It is. So pick it up for a holiday read.
Well, I have Garrick Jones calling in from Down Under for my interview today. So
I gave his review a glowing recommendation at the very start of the podcast, first episode. I think that it's going to be a great interview.
Yes, you gave him the glowing review for the Cricketer's Arms, and we are talking about Australia's Son this time around, his newest novel that just came out.
Is that a mystery?
It is a mystery.
I'm looking forward to it. He does a fine mystery.
That he does. So kick back and relax and enjoy it.
Okay. See you next week.
Okay. I'll see you then.
You can keep up with the Gay Mystery Authors on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Links are on our website, gaymysteryauthors.com.
My guest today is Garrick Jones. Garrick says he went from the outback to the opera. After a 30-year career as a professional opera singer, performing in opera houses and in concert halls all over the world, he took up a position as lecturer in music at the Central Queensland Conservatorium of Music in Australia. Brought up between the bush and the beaches of the eastern suburbs, he now lives in the tropics in peaceful environment. Hello, Garrick.
G'day, Brad.
How are things in the tropics today?
They're very hot and very humid.
Well, it still sounds lovely, and I'm a little bit jealous, I believe.
I'm staring out my office window into all the palm trees and the hibiscus in flower and the heliconias. It's not a bad place to be.
Well, now I am jealous, so yeah, rub it in. Well, let me start out. You've written dramas, story of espionage, erotica, and two mysteries.
Yep.
And you have a third one on the way, correct?
Yes, I have. Oh, look, I've got at the moment with the editor in the UK is my book about clash of Indigenous and European cultures in Australia immediately after the Second World War. But at the moment, I'm also writing the sequel to The Cricketer's Arms, which is the first mystery that I published earlier in the year.
Well, what is it about mysteries that you find interesting?
I suppose I was thinking about this the other day when I was listening to the last podcast. I was brought up with a grandmother who we didn't get television in Australia until 1956 when the first Olympic Games were held here in Melbourne. So before that, when I was growing up, it was the radio. And every Sunday night there was a radio mystery play. And my grandmother used to sit there clacking her needles and knitting, and about 5 minutes into the broadcast she'd always say, "Oh, the husband did it," or "the valet did it." So I was brought up with this spoiler of a grandmother, and I just sort of got interested in mysteries, and I've mostly read in my life sci-fi mysteries or police thrillers, procedurals.
Well, that's interesting. Any sci-fis coming up?
I started on a sci-fi, but I put it to one side. It's going to need a lot of work. I wrote the first three chapters and I got straight into the sex and I thought, no, it has to wait to come a bit later. So that's in the queue.
Well, your most recent novel, as you said, is Australian Sun.
Yep.
And that's currently available. What can you tell us about the story?
The story is an Edwardian, set in the Edwardian period. For those of you in the US, that's the period that we call from 1900 through to about 1914 when Edward VII came to the throne. And that, I don't know what, do you call it that period, over the same period over there?
Yes, we do.
Right.
So it's not, I will say it's not used very often except when we're talking about architecture.
Righto. So it's set in that period and it's set in 1902 and it's a story, it's a theatre murder mystery. It's a story of Australia's most famous baritone who comes home from the theatre after a performance and the police arrive early in the morning to tell him that his dresser, that's the person who works in the theatre with you, helping you in and out of your costumes, has been found dead sitting in his chair in the theatre. And that's the start of the story.
Now, the novelist protagonist, Edward Murray,
yep.
he is an opera singer.
That's right.
And other than the time era, his career seems very much like yours. How much of you would you say is in Edward?
Well, a lot of it. Ever since I started writing, I've been encouraged to write about my history as a performer. But quite honestly, there's so many people still alive, I think I'd end up in the court being sued. So I thought this was a way around it, writing a story about what it was like to be in the theatre before about the 1990s when everything became computerised. When I first started performing in the late 1960s, everything was pretty well the way it was right through to the end of the Victorian period, except for electric lighting, of course, but with stagehands doing everything. These days, people sit up in a booth at the back and they press buttons and it's all pre-worked out, all the set changes are all electronically operated. So there was quite a different feeling in the theatre back then. It was very very busy backstage. A lot of people would be very surprised to see how much went on behind the curtain that they were unaware of out the front. For example, in the wings, you could turn around, there'd be probably a dozen people on either side going about their business while you're performing. And I wanted to write about that, and I thought, this story is based on fact. A friend of mine in Stuttgart, when I was singing in Germany, his best friend was killed in a dressing room. And that story always stuck to me. During the performance, somebody sneaked in the back door and killed this guy in the dressing room. And I thought, oh, this would make a good story one day. So I thought I'd combine my history of being a performer, what it's like to be a performer, because you don't get to read about that very much, with a murder mystery. It seemed like killing two birds with one stone. The interesting thing, of course, is that the victim, the dresser, works as Edward Murray's double. Sometimes they need a double, a first person who's exactly the same size and shape and wear the costumes to do things on the stage made up to appear to be the singer. And in this case, it's a case of mistaken identity. The killer thinks he's killed Edward Murray, but in fact he's killed his best friend, the dresser, instead. So the story is all about trying to find out why and who it is trying to kill him.
You've had a very interesting and successful career singing in opera houses around the world, and you've now become a writer. What's that story?
That's another thing I started to think about. I grew up in a period in the 1950s when the only way of communicating with other people was by writing letters. There were obviously no emails. We lived at a million miles from anywhere, so the telephone was a luxury. So to communicate with anybody, we wrote letters. And so the art of writing was something that was concentrated upon very heavily at school, both in primary school and high school. And in those days, people were judged not only by the way they presented themselves, like how well they were dressed, but also how well they communicated. So letter writing was an enormous skill. When you applied for a job, you were shortlisted, I suppose, by your ability to put down words correctly. So I started writing, and I'd always been interested in research. So while I was performing, I did my undergraduate degree and two master's degrees and started a PhD while I was performing, writing in dressing rooms. And all of my supervisor's comments back were, gee, you write well. This is really good writing. Why don't you think about writing a textbook? I did write a textbook. And then when I retired 6 years ago, I thought, I'm going to have a stab at writing a novel. And that's when my first book, The 7th of December, was written. And I didn't know it was going to be any good or not. I just wrote it. And no one more surprised than me to find out that an editor, a publisher, really loved it and decided to publish it.
Did you do any writing earlier that perhaps you didn't put towards a publisher or try to publish?
Yes. My first book only came out this time last year, 12 months ago. And before that, in the 6 years since I retired, I wrote 9 books, but I didn't send them to anyone because I didn't know if it was any good or not. I mean, I'm like every writer in the world, I suffer from imposter syndrome. And it was only when a friend of mine, Alexander Voinov, I don't know if you know him, he's another writer who writes this gay books, encouraged me to send something to him and basically to check the German in it, because I was writing dialogue in both French and in German. And he said, you need to have this professionally edited, go through the process, see what it's like, get the story refined, and then send it to an editor. And it was through him that I sent it off, and blow me down, the publisher said, we love this, what else have you got?
Well, I haven't read Australia's Son yet, but having read your other novels, I think we should thank him because he was right on target. You do a fine job.
Oh, thanks, Brad.
Now, what surprised you about becoming an author?
That the writing is the easiest part of the whole process. It's all the other crap that you have to put. Not crap is not a good word, but all of the the promoting at the end once the book's out, getting your name out there, getting people to read your books, getting people to comment upon it. That's the hard part, I think. It's not so much the writing, which for me is very, very enjoyable. I love writing. It's all the other stuff that goes around it. And in the background, there's that terrible fear we have in Australia of self-promoting. We don't like it. There's something in our makeup that doesn't allow us to want to appear better than anybody else around us. We call it the tall poppy syndrome.
Well, and I think artists in general have are not marketers in their blood, and unfortunately, yeah, it has to be part of the job.
Oh yeah, there's so much about, and even if you get it, the interesting part is getting this group of people, finding your niche in writing, finding the type of people who appreciate the way that you put the words on the page, the way that you string together your thoughts. I write, all of the stuff that I write is driven from the character. That's where it comes from. I'm interested in people. I always have been. And that comes from being a performer. When we're rehearsing an opera, the director, if he's a very good one, will ask you the motivation. We hear this thing all the time about actors of motivation. But what causes somebody to do something? Even when we're sitting down at our desk and we get up to go and make a cup of tea, there's a thought that goes through our minds that makes us want to get up from our chair, walk to the kitchen and put a cup of tea on. And is that thought, I'm thirsty, or is it, I need a break? So there's a motivation behind everything we do, and that's the point from which I do all of my writing. What drives a character?
Well, one thing you told me previously is that you love to write about your country and the thing that makes Aussies and their history different from the rest of the world. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, for sure. When I first... Look, the first gay book I ever discovered was a book called The Catch Trap by Marion Zimmer Bradley. And I bought it in a book sale, believe it or not, when they're selling secondhand books outside the Air Force Base in Wiesbaden, the American Air Force Base. And I saw this book and I read the back cover, and it's a love story between two trapezists in the 1950s. And it was the first gay book other than Jean Genet and the people of that ilk in the 1950s that I'd read. And I became interested. I thought, my whole life I spend interpreting heterosexual relationships into the relationships that I have, which are relationships with other men, gay relationships. And I wanted to read more. And there was plenty of American and UK stuff out, but for the life of me, I could not find much Australian literature written about my country and through gay eyes. There's a lot of angstful stuff about the AIDS crisis, but there was nothing about but sort of like normal blokes and the way that men fall in love. I wanted to read stuff about it. And when I couldn't find anything, I thought maybe I should write something. And that's where my series, The Boys of Bullaroo, started from that point.
Well, I can tell you when reading your novels, you definitely get a feel, at least what I believe would be like being in Australia. But have you found yourself perhaps subconsciously writing for an audience beyond the borders of Australia?
This is something I think about a lot, Brad, and a lot of people who live in other countries don't think about that. You and I have an ongoing friendship, and I'm often writing to you and I say, what does this mean? When I see American slang, I remember the, what was the one that gnarly, that was the recent one I asked you about. What you take for granted that you understand, people in other countries may not. So when I read American literature, I'm often having to go and find a reference point for either points of interest or words that are used within the text that I don't understand. So that gives the colour and the flavour. Your own book, The Body in the Bathhouse, I looked up several things in that. You and I had a conversation about the word, the use of the word kettle, for example. That gave me a colour and an idea of your country and the people about whom you are writing. So I feel that when I'm writing about Australia, I shouldn't try and translate words that are instantly available to people who come from other cultures, but to give them a chance, like I need to do, is to actually explore a bit and find out what that word means. I think Justine, when she was doing a review on the Cricketers' Arms, mentioned, did you know what sly grogger was? Now, anybody in Australia knows what a sly grogger is, but that's a bit of colour. And from that experience, Justine went and read more just about the meaning of the word, but what it's associated with, and therefore got a better idea of the picture I was creating on the page. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. So you stay true to yourself is what you're saying.
Yeah, I can't be anybody else. I can only pull bits of me up and put them on the page. Often, I think I told you, I spent 2 years writing a book, which I finished recently, about a man with OCD and PTSD, which just tore me apart to write. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere, but I went through a really cathartic experience and almost a therapeutic experience writing that book to get out a lot of my inner demons. And I think that every writer does that no matter what they're writing about. We pull stuff outside from the inside out through our words and expose ourselves upon the page.
I do want to let listeners know that Garrick does occasionally ask me what particular sentences and phrases mean, and occasionally he even stumps me when it's an American term. But getting back to what you just said, I do agree. As you know, my protagonist in my first story also had PTSD, which I do not have, but I deal with some of the same demons. And so I do definitely understand where you're coming from, and I agree with you that much of what you write does need to come from within.
If you want to be true, we can we look at sitcoms on the TV and none of us think that that's actually true, but then we look at some really good drama on the television or in a film or something, and we instantly relate. That doesn't matter what culture you come from, there's something intrinsic about emotions that people from every culture can understand on the screen. And hopefully when you're writing, that's what you're hoping to do. You're hoping to expose part of general humanity to other people so they associate with that. That might sound very grand, but that's the way I go about writing. I try to write from something with inside.
No, I would agree with you. There's a saying to write what you know, and I believe that's true definitely in the beginning, but if you continue to write what you know, you're going to run out of things to write about. So you need to do a little study and find other things to tell a story. But in the end, it's still human feelings and human actions. And
for sure, that's what motivates everybody on God's earth, you know, we have the same sort of drama, theatre, poetry, prose, no matter what language or what culture we come from. It's all about those same basic feelings.
I know you have a passion for research and authenticity. How much of your time is spent conducting research?
Most of my time. This morning, the 2 hours I've been waiting to speak to you, I've been researching about the Romani culture. I have to be careful because people in the UK find the word gypsy very politically incorrect. So in the current story that I'm writing, the sequel to The Cricketers' Arms, which is called The Gilded Madonna, I'm researching what true Romani culture, fortune-telling, spirituality is all about. And I'd say that most of my day, when I'm not actually putting down words on a page, is researching. Because I can tell you what, as having been a performer for 30 years, if you do something on the stage, or the director asks you to do something on the stage, or your costume isn't quite right, and that somebody in the audience will pick that up and they'll write to you about it. Someone will let you know. If you make a mistake in your books about history or things that happened at a particular point in time, somebody will let you know. That's the sort of world we live in.
Oh, yeah, you are correct there. What's your process, generally speaking?
Okay, for research, I get an idea, like this current book I'm researching, the idea of Clyde Smith, who's the protagonist, being caught up wondering whether there is really some sort of thing behind behind the whole feeling of another world, whether people can tell fortunes or whether they can't. And his struggle to try and justify things that seem to be unknowable by anybody else but himself, with possibilities of how people could find out those facts and use them to their own effect. So I did a lot of research into, what's the word when people tell pick up stuff and they can tell what it means by, well, they can predict the future or the past by feeling it. There's a special word for it. It's gone from my mind immediately.
Telepathic?
No, that's really...
I'm not sure the exact word. It's escaping me, but I know what you're talking about. Like they pick up a watch and they can tell us.
Yeah, there's a special word for it. And stupid, I've been writing about it for the past week and I can't remember it. That's what happens when you're put on the spot. So I wanted to explore this idea of the supernatural world and how it can overlap into the present world, the reality, the real world. Let me put it like that. I mean, we've only got to look at Nancy and Ronald Reagan and see how they ran your country with mediums and fortune tellers and stuff. And to them, that was a real, real thing. It wasn't the way that I might look at it with a bit of skepticism. They believed in that. So I wanted to explore that in this book. So what I did was I started to read about it and I started to discover some of the minor traits of people from the Romani culture about animals, about touching, about giving things and offering things to other people, about the way they speak. And so that every little trail, everything that you read, like I read this thing about them not allowing animals to sit on their lap, and I thought, that's really interesting. Where does that come from? Then I started to do research on that. And then that led to another research trail. So making notes from that in the wonderful program that you told me about, OneNote, I get a research trail, which then gives me ideas to move forward on the story with.
Well, you may have already answered this question, but what is the most interesting thing you've learned in your research?
What is the most interesting thing I've learned in my research? I suppose the most interesting thing I learned in my research was about Edward VIII, who married Wallis Simpson and went on to be the governor of the Bahamas during the Second World War, and how they had the crown, the king, George VI, put a guard on the island to keep an eye on his brother because he thought that the Germans might attempt to kidnap him by submarine and bring him back to Germany to be part of the Third Reich, because he was very pro-Nazi. That was the thing that surprised me the most. So there was an armed guard there with a gun with orders to shoot the king if the Nazis managed to try and smuggle him away by submarine.
Well, you are always full of interesting facts. That is fascinating. So what's the most humorous thing you've learned?
The most humorous thing that I've learned. Let me think. That he's dead now, so I can talk about it. I won't mention his name, but I used to sing with a very large Italian tenor who was very standoffish, and I actually put him into Australia's Son with a different name. And he had terrible digestion. He used to fart really, really loudly on the stage. and, you know, the audience couldn't hear it. But we did a performance of an opera by Rossini called La Cenerentola, which was Cinderella, basically. And there was a section right at the end where we all had to kneel down in a pause in the total silence and bow to this girl who had been the chimney sweep who turned into the princess. And this total silence, this guy let rip so loudly, it hit the back of the theatre. And not only did we laugh, the audience laughed and the orchestra laughed as well. We couldn't go on. So that was a real life experience. That wasn't research.
That's a good enough story. I don't care whether it was research or not. Yeah. I would have loved to have been there.
And it was actually the King's Theatre at Aberdeen. I remember it very, very clearly.
Now, what writers have inspired you?
Several. I suppose from sci-fi, there's a writer called Greg Bear, who's relatively unknown, and Frank Herbert, of course. Greg Bear wrote a series called Eternity Eon, which is a combination of time travel and meeting other races throughout the universe. And he had a very clever way of writing, which I really liked. I saw through the fantastical and into the people behind that made the story go forward. And Frank Herbert, of course, the Dune series, it's extraordinary writing. Then for crime, there's an American female writer called Tammy Hoag, who I absolutely love. She writes a bit of romance, and I'm not fond of her romance, but she writes terrific police procedurals in which the protagonist is a very strong, capable woman who's always fighting the men who are trying to put her down. I suppose they're my two favourite fiction writers. I've got a lot of her books, and I've got a lot of Greg Bear's books and Frank Herbert's books as well.
Are there any gay or queer mystery writers that you enjoy?
I've found it very, very difficult. I'm just reading a book by John Inman at the moment. It's not a mystery. Oh, I suppose it is a mystery. It's set in I think you called it a cozy mystery. It's set in a haunted house in which the murderer has to be one of the people within this haunted house in which they're all trapped. But of recent years, since I started writing myself, I found it very hard to have time to read. I don't know if you're the same. I try to, but my time is mostly spent writing. And so when I do have spare time, I'm too exhausted. But I do have a list of books I want to read. John Michelson's, Matt's books, any number of books I want to read. But finding the time when I can devote myself to reading is really a bit tough at the moment.
Yeah, I had this conversation with an interview with Gregory Ashe, and it is, as a writer, we know it's very important to keep up with our craft and should study it. But at the same time, if you're writing, how do you have time to read? It's conflicting.
I've got four books on the go at the same time at the moment in various stages of preparation for publication. So that's juggling. That's a bit of a nightmare. But mind you, it's a rod of my own making. I understand that. And I'm happy to put my hand up and say, even though I get frustrated and annoyed with myself, I love every minute of it.
Now, one thing about you is, and I brought this up earlier, the different genres. Most writers find a niche or a genre and they stick with it. And you haven't. Do you believe you'll continue to write a variety types of novels?
Yes, I've got the stories come out of the ideas. I know that sounds like stating the bloody bleeding obvious, but it's true. The idea sticks in my mind, and from that, the story sort of more or less makes itself. I can't form it into the genre if it's not about the genre. This next book of mine to come out, The House with a Thousand Stairs, is based on my childhood growing up with the Indigenous country in outback Australia, combined with being brought up in a family that basically lived the way that they had done in the 1880s, right up until the 1950s. So it's a combination of living with the land and living with the Indigenous community around them. So I wanted to write a story about Indigenous spirituality and how that crosses into white man's life and what it's like to be a European person looking into that Indigenous culture from the outside, which was my position as a young man.
Well, now we have reached my favorite part of the interview.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Awkward questions writers get.
Right.
And you told me before you're a little nervous about this one.
I made notes, but I can't find them. I'm just looking on my computer screen.
Oh, you'd have no idea where I'm going anyway.
Okay.
Okay. So let's spin the wheel here. Okay, this one's not too hard, I don't think. Your question is, writing books is nice and all, but don't you have any real hobbies?
Well, actually, I do. Last year, I thought, I play the piano, having been a musician. I still teach singing one day a week privately. So playing the piano gives me a huge amount of satisfaction. I actually originally started off to be a concert pianist, but I had an accident which involved injuring my right arm. So that's how I came to be a singer. The head of the conservatorium said to me, well, you're never going to progress to be a concert pianist. What else can you do that doesn't involve your arm? I know, singing. So the artistic output has to do activity, hobby, has to do with either playing the piano or Photoshop, which I've discovered, and I've been doing courses for the past year on Photoshop, and I really, really love that.
Well, I want to say I'm sorry that you had the trouble with your hand, but having heard some of your singing, the world is blessed that you found that as a so-called hobby, which I think is way beyond that.
Yeah.
Now, Australia Sun, as we said, is your most recent novel. Where can readers purchase a copy?
It's available in all major bookstores, both online and I think some of the in Australia, a lot of the physical bookstores are stocking it. But any online bookstore, including Amazon, Smashwords, Kobo, Kindle, Apple, available through all platforms.
So all the major ones.
Yeah, both ebook and in paperback copy. Funnily enough, in Australia, we're very, very fond of paperback still. I know that's not so much the case in the US and the UK and Europe these days, but paperbacks are still very, very popular here. And I have a number of people who write to me and say, the 7th of December, for example, is not available in paperback. And a lot of people say, oh, we'll wait and we'll get that when it comes out in paperback. I suppose it's that thing of laying back in the warm summer days in Australia and with your feet up in a hammock and reading a book.
Well, I will tell you, there's some people that would argue with you on the not liking the book in other parts of the world. I've made no hesitation to tell people I much prefer a Kindle because I like being able to stick it in my pocket. But I know plenty of people that they want that feel, the smell, the everything about holding a real book in their hand. So,
well, the interesting thing is when I bought your book, I didn't get it on Kindle. I waited till it came out in paperback. And when it arrived, I stroked the cover and I thought, this is my mate Brad who wrote this. Look at that. I'm holding it in my hands. That was a great feeling to me.
Well, that's a great thing for me to hear. So thank you. Now, if someone would like to contact you, what's the best way to do that?
The best way to contact me is through my website, which is https://garrickjones.com.au, and there's an email address there, and I'm also available on Facebook. Just look me up. There's a famous footballer called Garrick Jones, could you believe it? And he's I don't know the politically correct term for that. He's an African-American. Am I allowed to say that?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I'm not sure. I'm never sure. I mean, we don't have that sort of problem in this country, but he was a football player, quite a famous football player. So sometimes I get emails for him, and I wonder if he gets emails for me. It might give him a bit of a shock.
Well, once again, I want to tell everybody that your most recent book is The Mystery Australia Sun, and as you said, it's available pretty much everywhere.
It is.
And I do want to thank you for your time. It's been great to talk to you, as always.
Oh, it's wonderful talking to you, Brad. Perhaps you should let people know that you and I have a long-term friendship. We met on an accountability page, and we spent time crying on each other's shoulders, and we became pals from that. And I thank every day that I met you, and you keep me going at times when days are black and the depression hole is deep. And I love you for that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I love you for that as well, because those days of holding each other and crying through our novels has not ended. It didn't just start with that group. So, yes, Garrick and I have been good friends for quite some time now.
Yep.
Glad I finally have you on the show.
Okay, now I need to give you an Australian farewell. Hooroo, Brad. That's what we say when we say goodbye. Hooroo.
Hooroo.
Hooroo. Yep.
Well, goodbye.
See you later. It's been lovely talking to you.
Same to you. Thank you.
Thank you.